From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Tony Blair, past, present, and future. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. It's been the worst-kept political secret in years, and today Blair finally set the date. He'll submit his resignation to Queen Elizabeth on June 27th. By that time, the majority Labour Party is expected to have chosen Chancellor Gordon Brown as the next Prime Minister. On To the Point, we'll look at Blair's accomplishments and his failures. Will support for the war in Iraq damage his legacy or enhance it? What will Blair's absence mean for President Bush? And what's the future for leadership of the European Union? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Pope Benedict XVI and abortion in Latin America. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International. Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Tony Blair says 10 years is enough, and he'll step down as British Prime Minister on June 27th. On To the Point, we'll look at Blair's record, including peace in Northern Ireland and support for the war in Iraq. What will his departure mean for President Bush and the European Union? On Reporter's Notebook, in Brazil, Pope Benedict XVI is talking about excommunication for politicians who favor abortion. First, this news update, with the House expected to pass a new Iraq spending bill this evening. President Bush said again today he will not accept a provision for funding in two installments with a cutoff in July.
So I'll veto the bill if it's this haphazard piecemeal funding, and I made that clear. One message I have heard from people from both parties and is that the idea of benchmarks makes sense, and I agree. It makes sense to have benchmarks as a part of our discussion on how to go forward.
The president said Chief of Staff Josh Bolton has been empowered to continue negotiating with Congress on the benchmarks. Jonathan Weissman is congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Jonathan, always good to have you with us.
Thanks, Warren.
Is that new? Is this an opening we haven't seen before on the benchmarks?
Not really. I mean, look, President Bush is the one who proposed the whole idea of benchmarks in that January address to the nation when he was laying out the surge. He hasn't said much about it since then, but the administration officials who have been up here negotiating have made it clear that they are willing to do benchmarks. The fight is over the consequences to not meeting the benchmarks, not the benchmarks themselves. The benchmarks themselves were exactly the ones that President Bush laid out in his January speech.
Well, now there was this, or there is in the House bill at least, a deadline for funding of July. And the president said, wait a minute, General Petraeus, the commander now in Iraq, is going to report back to him in September. Let's wait and see what General Petraeus says in September. What do you think are the implications of that statement?
Well, you know, for some days now, September has been clearly the kind of point where the political calendar dovetails with the military calendar. And Republicans and Democrats alike are saying that if General Petraeus cannot show significant progress by then, that both parties are going to demand a significant change of course in Iraq. And that is truly the timeline that the administration is operating under now.
All right. In the meantime, the House is expected to pass this bill tonight. You're in the Senate gallery, as I understand it, Senate Press Gallery, where the senators are saying, forget it, we're not going to vote for that bill.
That's right. The House is in a process right now of trying to keep the liberal Democrats together with the moderates and the conservatives. In fact, the liberals were in full-scale revolt over this two-tranche approach yesterday. Nancy Pelosi met with them last night, and to ensure passage, and it's not insured, but to pretty much ensure passage of the two-tranche bill tonight, She promised them today, this evening, they will have a vote for the first time on legislation to cut off funding for the war. That legislation is not likely to pass. In fact, I can bet you $1 million that it won't pass. But it is the first vote of this kind since Vietnam.
Jonathan Weissman, congressional reporter for The Washington Post. So the very anti-war wing, then, of the party in Congress wants to get tough, wants to be able to tell their constituents that we're not backing down, even though it's highly likely that even the Democratic Party as a whole won't go for it.
Exactly. I mean, basically, each step of the way, as the Democratic leadership pulls back from fixed timelines for withdrawing troops, they're having all these problems with the liberals, and they're having to offer some kind of concessions with the understanding that eventually they have to give President Bush a bill that funds the war and that will not contain the kind of strings that would fundamentally end the war.
Now, for his own part, of course, President Bush, as you pointed out today in the Washington Post, is having problems with his own party, what you describe as a remarkably blunt White House meeting yesterday. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it actually happened on Tuesday.
Excuse me.
A group of 11 moderate Republicans, they're calling themselves the Tuesday Group, marched down to the White House. They sat in the private residence of the White House with the president, with the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State. Karl Rove was there, so was Tony Snow, the press secretary. And they just basically delivered in the Riot Act. Now, of course, they did not say they were going to vote for any of these Democratic motions yet. But one of the congressmen said, look, you are destroying the Republican Party here. We cannot keep this up. They demanded what plan B would be. President Bush would not give them a plan B. He said that if he offered up a plan B now, all of the attention would be on that, and nobody would be giving plan A a chance. But he offered assurances to them that at least there is a plan B, that they are planning contingencies in case this troop surge doesn't work. But this was the people who I talked to said this was the most frank, by far the bluntest conversation they had ever had with a president.
All right. Trouble on both sides of the aisle, particularly, though, in the White House. Jonathan Weissman, congressional reporter for The Washington Post, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, Tony Blair, past, present, and future on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. After announcing his plans to his cabinet today in London, Tony Blair told his Sedgefield constituency in northern England he will resign as prime minister on June 27th. 10 years, he said, is enough. Naomi Grimley reports on politics for the BBC. Ms. Grimley, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
This has been telegraphed for days. Were there any surprises?
Not really. One thing that did surprise observers, though, was the tone that Tony Blair struck in his speech. Everyone was expecting him to announce his resignation around now, so there's no surprises in the date. But the tone was a funny mix between defiant on his foreign policy, for example, and also a mixture of humility and apology, even, for the times that he felt he might have let down the British people. And he actually acknowledged in his speech that he may have raised expectations a little too high at the start of his premiership.
What specifically was he talking about?
It's difficult to know. He finished his speech with an apology, saying, I'm sorry for the times I've let you down. Now, some people will interpret that as meaning Iraq. But in fact, if you look earlier on in the speech, Tony Blair was, as I said, defiant about Iraq. He said that he made the decision, he thought it was the right thing to do, and he still believes that Britain must see that through and not heed the calls for an early withdrawal of troops. So it's difficult to know exactly what he meant by his semi-apology. I think it was more a sense that he was worried he'd let people down in some way.
He announced that he would submit his resignation to the Queen on June 27th. Tell our American audience what happens after that.
Right. Well, actually, I'll tell you first what happens between now and that date, which is what will happen is there'll be a leadership contest within the British Labour Party to elect a new leader. Now, that is most likely going to be Gordon Brown, who's the Chief Finance Minister at the beginning at the moment. However, there's still got to be some kind of contest. He may be challenged by a rather feeble challenge from the left wing. But nevertheless, that contest will take place. Then when Tony Blair has said he'll go on the 27th of June, there will be a trip for him to Buckingham Palace to hand over the seals of state to the Queen. And then the Queen will formally ask the winner of that contest to take over and form a government. And as I say, most people think that will be this guy called Gordon Brown, who's the Chief Finance Minister at the moment.
And what changes are expected in British policy, domestic and foreign, when Gordon Brown takes off? I know that's a question that'll take some time to answer. We have other guests on the line. But just in general, what do you anticipate?
Just very briefly, then, I think we'll see not an end to the special relationship with America by any means, but I think we'll see a rather cooler, less dramatic relationship with Washington. I think we'll see more focus on climate change and overseas aid in foreign policy rather than hard military might. And I think domestically, we'll have to see the consolidation of some of the reforms which Tony Blair instituted but haven't quite yet worked. So Mr. Brown will have to find some way of making sure that the health service and education are reformed to the extent that the British public want them.
Why is there no general election? Why don't the British people choose the Prime Minister?
Good question. It's just the way the British Constitution works, that really it's the Queen that asks the successor to form a government. There is no mechanism for a general election, unless, of course, his successor wanted to call one to get a democratic mandate. But we think that's very unlikely. So you do have this constitutional situation where you get a successor being able to be made Prime Minister without actually having a proper election for him across the country.
And when then, after the seals have been turned over and Gordon Brown has been invited, presumably it will be he to lead the nation, what's next for Tony Blair?
Well, that's also a good question. We're not quite sure. We think he'll probably try and have a role rather like Bill Clinton's, a kind of roving ambassador across the world. Climate change is a big issue for him. He's also expressed an interest in making sure that peace in the Middle East is secured, though the problem with that for him is that, of course, the shadow of Iraq rather does overhang him, and so in that respect, some people may not want him as the person to help broker some kind of peace agreement.
One of the British papers, as I understand it, reported that he might, in fact, be a sort of special envoy for President Bush in the Middle East. Is anybody taking that report seriously?
Well, he has expressed a desire to, as I say, help bring the two sides together in the Middle East. But I wouldn't expect him to be an actual ambassador of George Bush's, simply because in the past he suffered from this impression, this characteristic that the British press have sometimes thrown at him of being Bush's poodle. He wouldn't want, I think, to take any kind of job which made him look like he was sort of signing up to the Bush administration's agenda in quite that way. He may agree with Mr. Bush on many things, but he will want to keep his distance to a certain extent so that historians don't say that he was too naive or that he was too trusting and essentially subjugated British policy to an American policy, which is what some historians do already say.
So back to the secession question. How long will it be for Gordon Brown as Prime Minister before there will be another general election? How is that determined?
Well, in Britain, you only need to have a general election every 5 years. And so he could call one whenever he wanted to. If he wanted to go to the country in October, he could call for an election then. But otherwise, he can really he can do what he wants until the 5 years is up. Now, we had the last election in 2005, so the next one would be due in 2010. That's when he would have to call one, but he's not obligated to call one in between time.
And what are the likely issues that he will be faced with first as he takes over as Prime Minister?
I think the biggest issue is finding a way of reconciling the differing views both within his party and within the country as a whole over Iraq. He will probably have to not apologize for Iraq because he was part of the decision-making that Tony Blair took the decisions on Iraq. But he'll nevertheless have to find a way of saying we've learnt the lessons from what went wrong there. And on other domestic policies, he's got a big constitutional headache at the moment because a party that is in favour of Scottish independence has just won an election in Scotland, and that could cause big constitutional problems for him.
Well, Naomi Grimley, thank you very much for being with us.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Political reporter for the BBC World Service. As Ms. Grimley indicated, during his speech today, surrounded by vocal supporters in Sedgefield, Mr. Blair addressed the most controversial aspect of his 10 years as the leader of Britain, that, of course, his support for President Bush and the war in Iraq.
And then came the utterly unanticipated and dramatic September the 11th, 2001, and the death of 3,000 or more on the streets of New York. And I decided we should stand shoulder to shoulder with our oldest ally. And I did so out of belief. And so Afghanistan, and then Iraq. The latter bitterly controversial.
Tony Blair acknowledging how controversial that act became. Andrew Roberts' latest book is A History of the English-Speaking People Since 1900. He's also contributor to both the Daily Telegraph and The Spectator magazine. Mr. Roberts, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello.
What do you think history will say about Tony Blair and Iraq?
Well, I think a lot depends on whether we win in Iraq or not. If we do, I think there's a very good chance that that Tony Blair will be exonerated by history and vindicated. If, on the other hand, there's a early withdrawal or an outright defeat, then it's very possible that he'll go down as one of the worst prime ministers rather than one of the better ones.
What does win mean from a British standpoint?
I think it means the crushing of al-Qaeda and a democratic Iraq where the Iraqis themselves really not only just see their own future and dominate their own part of the world, but also are not a springboard for other terrorist attacks around the Middle East.
We've heard, of course, that Mr. Blair was referred to as Bush's poodle by his opponents as a result of his support for the war. We just heard Naomi Grimley of the BBC suggest that he might sort of distance himself from President Bush now in order not to emphasize what some people see as a kind of naive commitment to the United States. What do you think about that?
And, I don't think, actually, that's what Ms. Grimley said. What she actually said, I think, in answer to your question was that she wasn't going to become Mr. Blair wasn't going to become a kind of roving ambassador for Mr. Bush. And I don't think that that was ever likely either. I think that he's got two choices here. Either he tries to have his own kind of foundation, which won't, political foundation in the way that Mr. Clinton does, which won't in any way be thought of as a Bush poodle kind of thing. Or alternatively, he'll do what a number of people also think he might do, which is to make a bit of money and do what former prime ministers do in the way of going on the lecture circuit and writing their autobiographies and things like that. One has to remember that he's got a vast mortgage and he really does need to make a bit of money, and he's very likely to try that second option, I would have thought.
So history's verdict may take time to be formulated. What's your own, and do you support his support of the war in Iraq?
Yes, I think that standing shoulder to shoulder with the Americans, as you heard him just say, after 9/11 was absolutely the right thing to do. I think that he's not at all a poodle of Mr. Bush. The fact is that he sees British foreign policy and British interests around the world in much the same way as Mr. Bush sees American interests, and that doesn't make you a poodle. All it means is that we have, and have had for many, many years historically, an identity of interests with the Americans, and all he's done effectively is to ensure that no nation or no movement, certainly no terrorist organization, has been able to slip itself in between Britain and America. I think that's a very good thing.
Andrew Roberts, British historian, a contributor to the Daily Telegraph and the Spectator magazine. Mary Dashefsky is chief editorial writer for The Independent newspaper in London. Mary Dashefsky, always good to have you on our program.
It's very nice to be there.
Do Britons in general agree with Mr. Roberts that this was a good idea and that Mr. Blair was not Bush's poodle, or do they see it the other way around?
Well, I think all the recent opinion polls that have been taken show that by quite a large majority, the British public is very hostile to the British involvement in Iraq, that it wishes we weren't there, and also that they feel that Mr. Blair is still Bush's poodle simply because we're still in Iraq.
What about Mr. Brown, his successor?
Well, that's a very, very interesting question, because Gordon Brown has a reputation of being, if anything, more pro-American in his way of thinking than Tony Blair, and less, as it were, inclined to the European alliance. So all the previous signs are that Gordon Brown would lean towards America at the expense of Europe. Now, there are all sorts of theories and speculation going the rounds that say, well, actually, to show his distance from Tony Blair, he might actually become more pro-European than maybe we think, that he might put greater distance between himself and the US than Tony Blair has done. But of course, in a way, that's a bit easier for him, because with the Democrats controlling Congress and President Bush enduring so much opposition, actually to be seen to be a friend of America is maybe less of a liability for the next British Prime Minister than it has been for Tony Blair.
Let me go back to Andrew Roberts and ask you, has your side lost as far as British politics are concerned when it comes to support for the war in Iraq? And if so, what's the best you could expect from Mr. Brown?
Yes, my side is definitely lost. The lady from The Independent is absolutely right about that. It's not just lost in the country, but it's also lost in the Conservative Party. And the leader of the Conservative Party is probably more sceptical about the war in Iraq than Mr. Brown is, which is a strange thing, really, for us, because the Thatcherite right wing of the Conservative Party, which I hail from, has been effectively completely outmanoeuvred in its internal battles. What this means, as far as Mr. Brown is concerned, is that he has a slightly larger room for manoeuvre than Mr. Blair had, and I think he'll take advantage of that. But I think that any alteration he makes in American British foreign policy with regard to America will be cosmetic, frankly, because he did sit in every single cabinet meeting that took every single decision with regard to the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq and the subsequent occupations and fighting that's taken place there. And therefore, he really does have his hands cuffed to the machine, as it were.
So, Mary Dashefsky, is that right? Is Mr. Brown in many ways then cuffed, as Andrew Roberts said?
Well, he has been so far. That's absolutely definite. What we don't know is what he might say when he comes to office. Yes, he was in all the meetings that decided to go with the Americans into Iraq, but at the same time, he seemed a rather unwilling participant. He only came out in public in favor of the engagement in Iraq very late in the day, and only when Tony Blair really, really needed his support. So there again, around London, there are sort of rumours that maybe one of the things he could do would distance himself, not from the decision. He's culpable for that with Tony Blair, but for what happened afterwards, to say that he regrets this.
Okay, we'll come back and continue this conversation in just a moment on To the Point. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, Pope Benedict XVI and abortion in Latin America. Back in a moment with To the Point.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point, talking today about Tony Blair stepping down after 10 years as Prime Minister of Great Britain. He's announced his resignation will be on June 27th. Between now and then, the Labour Party will choose most likely the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown, to be his successor. And then on June 27th, there will be a change in power. Today at the White House, President Bush was asked about all this. Here's what he had to say about Tony Blair.
First of all, I'll miss Tony Blair. He is a political figure who is capable of thinking over the horizon. He's a long-term thinker. I have found him to be a man who's kept his word, which sometimes is rare in the political circles I run in.
President Bush at the White House today. He also spoke about Gordon Brown, whom he has met at least once. Here's what he had to say here.
I have had a meeting with him and found him to be an open and engaging person. It's amazing how, you know, people make all kinds of characterizations about people in the political process. And I found him to be a easy to talk to, good thinker.
Still with us, Mary Dushevsky, chief editorial writer at the Independent newspaper in London. When that meeting took place, it was a sort of a staged accidental meeting in the White House, as I understand it, and it didn't get a very good reception in Britain, did it?
No, well, it put the very idea of meeting George Bush put Gordon Brown in a very difficult position, because on the one hand, he needed to have met President Bush to give him the sort of status back home to show that he was international leader in the making. On the other hand, the liability of being seen with President Bush, talking to him, looking again like a sort of Bush poodle Mark II, this was very bad for him at home. So we tend to think that that's why this particular mechanism of the drop-by meeting was staged for him, so that it could, if you like, be denied almost as a formal meeting.
Apparently, Mr. Bush sort of stuck his head in the door as Mr. Brown was meeting with somebody else in the White House.
Yes, that's apparently how it happened. Apparently, though, we do believe that it were the possibility, or indeed the probability, was mooted in advance, and it wasn't quite so chance as it appeared.
Well, Mary Dushevsky, always good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Chief editorial writer of the Independent newspaper in London. Charlie Kupchan is former National Security Council staff, or was on the National Security Council staff during the first Clinton administration. He is now director of Europe Studies and senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also professor at Georgetown University. And Charlie Kupchan, good to have you back at our program.
Glad to join you again.
How much of a blow is it to President Bush at this point, a blow obviously that was telegraphed well in advance, not to have Tony Blair anymore, his major supporter internationally in the war in Iraq?
There's no question that Bush is going to miss Tony Blair. He said so himself, and that's because Blair has been the most stalwart ally and supporter of Bush from the get-go. And whether you support the war in Iraq or not, I think you have to give a certain amount of respect to Blair for standing by Bush's side, despite the fact that the war hasn't gone well. But I think that things have changed over the last few years. I mean, Bush has lost most of his buddies in Europe. Aznar in Spain is no longer in power. Berlusconi fell to Prodi in Italy. But Bush has two new friends, Nicolas Sarkozy in Paris, who just won the election last Sunday, and Angela Merkel in Germany. And therefore, U.S. policy toward Europe is, I think, shifting to the east. It will focus more on ties to Paris and Berlin, less on the special relationship, so-called special relationship, with the U.K. And that may mean that Bush is not as bad off with the departure of Blair as he might otherwise be.
Well, what about Gordon Brown? He is, by all accounts, as we just heard, very much a pro-American person. He was certainly in on the decisions having to do with Iraq. Is it assumed in this country that Mr. Brown will be spending all his time trying to show that he's not Tony Blair and not Bush's poodle, or will he quite naturally be supportive?
I think in the end of the day, he will be supportive. I mean, the tie between the U.S. and the U.K. runs deep. But I do think that first of all, as some of your other guests mentioned, he has to be careful not to follow the footsteps of Blair and end up being seen as a toady of Bush. And secondly, he's a very different kind of guy than Blair. He's much, much more cerebral. He's more of an introvert. He thinks about the world in economic terms, not in geopolitical terms. And I think he's therefore going to want to take a much lower profile on the global stage. He's not going to want to get out in front of issues in the same way that Blair did. So that may mean that Bush simply doesn't have a blocker out front, and that the UK in some ways moves to the middle of the pack as an ally of the United States, partly because those will be Gordon Brown's instincts, but also because he doesn't want to follow the footsteps of Blair and get tainted with the brush of too close to Bush.
Charles Kupchan, again, formerly with the Clinton administration. Back to Andrew Roberts, our British historian and contributor to the Daily Telegraph and The Spectator. How important, we heard earlier that about the polls in Britain with regard to Iraq, and I understand there's a more anti-Americanism there than there has been for a very long time. How important there is the so-called special relationship in terms of defense and in terms of the culture?
I think in terms of defense, it's still tremendously important. When one looks at matters, for example, to do with nuclear policy and to do with intelligence, it's central to our security, and therefore really it's a given of all British governments of both political parties that the special relationship matters. I think that it's a good thing, as we heard earlier, that Nicolas Sarkozy and Angela Merkel are neither of them making the kind of anti-American remarks that we heard in the earlier period of Schroeder and Chirac. But I think that most thinking Americans would still regard Britain as the ally that they can trust in a crisis more than the French and the Germans, and we certainly also feel that about Americans here. It's rather like a family row, I think. It can be bitter, it can be unpleasant, but at the bottom, most sensible people, especially ones who look at history, appreciate that this is the bedrock.
Charles Kupchan, do you think that's true in the United States as well? Is Britain regarded as family?
You know, I would say there's a certain schizophrenia on the issue. I would agree with Andrew that deep down inside there is a sense that we have a special connection to the British. And if you go back and you look at literature and opinion pieces about 100 years ago, people began to talk about war between the U.S. and Britain as a civil war, as fratricide, suggesting that we are, in fact, of the same stock. But I think that's changing slowly for two different reasons. One is simply demographics, that more and more of this country comes from East Asia or from Latin America, doesn't have European roots. And secondly, America's strategic priorities are shifting. They're shifting to the Middle East and to East Asia. And that simply means not that we don't continue to look to Europe as a partner, but that Europe is no longer the apple of our eye. It doesn't loom large in our geopolitical map of the world like it used to. So I think that the relationship will be strong, but it will simply matter less to both Americans and to Brits than it has for the last 50 years.
Let me introduce a new voice to this conversation. Stryker McGuire is the London Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. And Stryker McGuire, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
As we're talking about Europe, you wrote in Newsweek International recently and quoted Spiegel Online as saying, Merkel, Angela Merkel of Germany, is the new Tony Blair. What does that mean?
Well, it means a number of things. It means, first of all, that with Blair leaving, she becomes the most powerful head of government in Europe, and she becomes the sort of go-to woman, if you will, for the United States, but also for other countries. She's going to be, for a while, the principal leader, which in a sense makes sense because Germany is such a big economy, and it's heating up now. in a very impressive way. It's partly an accident of history, but it's also the fact that Angela Merkel has surprised a lot of people who didn't give her much credit when she came to office a little less than 2 years ago.
But in what way has she replaced Tony Blair? What was his role in Europe and the European Union?
Well, his role in Europe was often divisive. But if you go back to when he took office in 1997, he was the hot leader. He was the person who had reformed the Labour Party, the Social Democratic Party in Britain. He led the rest of Europe toward the center. He had a huge impact on the rest of Europe. Iraq came along and, of course, changed that to some extent. But even when he was hated in Europe for his association with George Bush, he was admired as an articulate and canny politician, and he was also seen as somebody who had turned his party into an amazing electoral machine, and the rest of Europe has followed him in many different ways.
Well, now, you say, though, that Angela Merkel is the likely successor. Germany's not on the Security Council. In what way can you make the case that, as you said, she's the most powerful head of state now in Europe?
Well, she's the most powerful because because other leaders are going to be very much tied down to business at home. You were talking about Gordon Brown earlier. Gordon Brown, for a lot of reasons, including the fact that he doesn't need to get close to George W. Bush. Gordon Brown has a huge repair job at home. His party is fractured. The country, the country simply has lost its trust in government. He has a lot of stuff to do at home. He's not going to be a towering figure at first on the international scene. Nicolas Sarkozy is in a very similar situation. He has huge problems at home to deal with, the French identity crisis, repairing the French economy. Merkel, therefore, is in effect the only one who has the authority to speak with a European voice. She also happens to be, again, quite by accident, she happens to hold the presidency of the European Council, and she is hosting the G8, of which she is president this year.
Strucker McGuire, London bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. Let me go back to Andrew Roberts. My understanding is you dined with Nicolas Sarkozy not very long ago, and I'm interested in your take on what we have just heard, and will he be competing, do you think, with Angela Merkel for leadership in the European community?
I think in the end, these things actually come down to things like GDP, frankly, and the French are going to be in no position to compete with the Germans in the foreseeable future, unless he does turn out to be another Margaret Thatcher. I mean, I know that's very much what he would like to be, but he's likely to face the same kind of internal strains and stresses as she did, and so it will be a great test of character for him to see whether or not he pulls it off. She did, it must be remembered, have an awful lot of luck on her side on occasion, and she also planned various clashes very carefully, and it remains to be seen whether he's got the same kind of strategic view that she has. But I think that from my meeting with him, one of the things I asked over supper was how he got on with Brown. And he said, Gordon Brown is my friend. I'm looking forward to working with him. I like Gordon Brown. Personally, I think he's going to be easier to deal with than Tony Blair, which wasn't what I was expecting at all. And it is rather pleasing to hear, frankly.
Easier than Blair in what respect?
Well, I think Sarkozy certainly thinks of himself as the charismatic leader, and so of course there's Tony Blair, so much more likely for them to have clashed than to have got on. Gordon Brown has been accused of a lot of things over the last 10 years, but charisma isn't one of them, and so as a result I think that these two maybe could get on rather well.
Andrew Roberts, again, with the Daily Telegraph, The Spectator, and author of A History of the English-Speaking Peoples Since 1900. Charles Kupchan, back to you, again, with the first Clinton administration, and now with the Council on Foreign Relations in the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. You mentioned American demographics changing and strategic priorities changing as well. Nonetheless, the Bush administration in the first term got into some trouble when Secretary Rumsfeld started talking about New Europe and Old Europe and sounding as if he was really disrespecting, if I can use that term, France and Germany, certainly, if not Britain, with Tony Blair. Doesn't the United States have to pay pretty close attention to what's happening with the European Union? And is it good for the U.S., do you think, and for the Bush administration that we're hearing the kind of dynamics we are?
Well, I think that the Bush administration in the second term has followed a very different policy and has woken up to the need that America needs help in the world, and the best place to get that help is from Europe, and a stronger Europe is better than a weaker Europe. And one of the things that could come out of the current changing of the guard in the EU and the UK and France and Germany is the following, that for the last 6 years or so, the main conduit of U.S. power in Europe has been the UK, but the UK has always been skittish about the EU, and therefore people sort of felt they had to choose. Are you an Atlanticist? Are you a European? Are you going to go with the European project, or do you want to tilt toward the U.S.? And it may well be that with Sarkozy in France and Merkel in Germany, both of whom are Atlanticists, this choice may go away. That is to say that there can be a strong Europe that is closely tied to the United States, and therefore nobody needs to make a choice one way or the other. And I think it's good that the U.S. may now be working more closely with Paris and Berlin rather than London, precisely because Paris and Berlin are the core of the European project. And one could at least speculate, although it's too soon to tell, that this shift eastward in American influence in Europe could help rebuild not just the EU, but also U.S. ties to a stronger and more collective Europe.
And Stryker McGuire in London for Newsweek. Final question to you. Do you think that because of the changes that you've pointed out yourself, we're going to hear about and see more in American media reports about Angela Merkel and what she's doing and why it's important to the United States?
Well, you will, because I think one of the reasons that she seeks closer ties with the United States, and that, by the way, means not just George Bush, but whoever is the next president as well. I think Europe is looking already beyond Bush in that way. But she's seeking ties for economic reasons, and she sees economic ties with America as something that Europe can benefit from in the future challenge against Asia.
Well, thank you all so much for being with us. Stryker McGuire with Newsweek in London, Charles Kupchan at the Council on Foreign Relations, Andrew Roberts, a British historian, once again, the latest book, A History of the English-Speaking People Since 1900, and our earlier guests, Mary Dashefsky of The Independent and Naomi Grimley of the BBC. Good to have you all with us and look forward to talking to you again on future programs. In Brazil, the world's largest Roman Catholic country, Pope Benedict XVI is emphasizing that politicians who vote to legalize abortion should exclude themselves from communion. That comes at a sensitive time for Brazil and other countries in Latin America, as we will hear in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Abortion is against the law in Brazil, except for very limited circumstances. The number of illegal abortions, though, is estimated at between 1 and 2 million a year. President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva recently said he's opposed to abortion himself, but that if the state abdicates from considering it as a public health question, that will lead to the deaths of many young women. Church leaders have denounced a proposal from his health minister for a national referendum. Jack Chang is South American correspondent for the McClatchy newspapers. And Jack, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So when the Pope got off the plane and started saying these things about abortion and how public officials might consider officially excommunicating themselves, if they were favorable toward abortion, what kind of response did he get?
Well, in Brazil, there was a muffled response. The Brazilian government has already been clashing with Brazilian bishops this week about the health minister's proposals. And on Monday, President Lula, he basically said he would support treating abortion as a public health issue. In Mexico, however, in Mexico City in particular, there was some harsh criticism of what the Pope said. Even the U.S., in our story that came out today, you know, we had Patrick Leahy and representatives of John Kerry critical of the statement. But in Brazil so far, it's been muted. Well, because I think largely because the Pope was talking about Mexico, so it'd be really kind of out of line for Brazilians to respond to what you're saying about Mexican legislators.
Senator Kerry, of course, got into trouble during the election when he was running because some of the Catholic bishops said he ought to be refused communion because he supported a woman's right to choose. Well, now it's being reported that the Vatican officials that are with the Pope are kind of trying to clarify in some way what he said. Do you think that the Pope misspoke in some way? Is it possible? Do popes misspeak?
Yeah. Well, it was a tricky situation because what happened was he was asked whether he agreed with the excommunication of these Mexican legislators. Now that question was incorrect because these legislators were not excommunicated. But then he answered yes. Basically, yes, I agree to that. And then he went on to explain how it was part of the canon law. So it was a strange situation because he was agreeing to something that hadn't actually happened. And that's what the his representatives later clarified. I think they clarified that on the plane, unless they're doing that today some more. But clarifying that he was just saying they should be refused communion and other sacraments.
Okay, so a very complicated issue, obviously, and perhaps as he arrives in the largest Catholic country in the world, he doesn't really want to get into a political controversy. What does his schedule call for? What's he going to be doing?
Well, he met today with President Lula, and they apparently, according to Brazilian media, did not talk about abortion, but President Lula did start the meeting apparently by reaffirming his belief in the value of the family as a centerpiece of public policy. Tonight, the Pope is going to be speaking at a football stadium here to some 40,000 youth from around South America. I just came back from there, and there's people from all over the continent there. Tomorrow, he's going to be canonizing Brazil's first native-born saint, that 18th century monk who is already, you know, very revered in especially in southern Brazil. And then he goes Saturday to the town of Aparecida, which is about 100 miles from Sao Paulo. And there on Sunday he'll open the fifth Bishops' Conference of Latin American Caribbean.
Why is he visiting Brazil, particularly at this moment in history?
Well, I mean, he said very clearly in that same press conference yesterday that the rise of Protestant churches in Latin America is a great worry for him and the church. In Brazil, the number of, and that rise has come at the cost of Catholics. In Brazil, the number of Catholics has dropped from 89% in 1980, according to the census. And then there was a poll that came out just Sunday that showed it was down to 64%. As of this year. So, and then meanwhile, they call them evangelicals, but the Protestant churches have grown from 7% in 1980 to 22% this year. And about three-quarters of that is Pentecostal Protestant churches. So that's, just numerically, it's worrying. And, the Catholic Church has been very clear that's why the Pope is here.
Why have the evangelicals and particularly Pentecostal churches become so popular in Brazil?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. It seems they offer very, kind of a flashy show business. It has this sort of a show business flash to their services. I went to one service 2 weeks ago. You know, they had dancers in sequined costumes. They had you know, big musical numbers. It looked like a big Broadway show. And then there was this big emphasis on miracles and how, you know, the material benefits of prayer and, you know, how they were emphasizing how people were getting job offers and pay raises. And it's a very sort of maybe a tangible form of Christianity. And then there's criticism that the Catholic Church has been very slow to adapt to the new reality here. And this is happening all over Latin America. This isn't just Brazil. This is a region-wide phenomenon.
What's the new reality that the Catholics have been slow to adapt to?
Well, one reality is, social attitudes are changing. In that same poll that I mentioned that came out Sunday, they found that even Catholics, 74% of Brazilian Catholics are in support of divorce. They're 94% or just the right to get a divorce. 94% support the use of contraception. Almost half support the right for gays to marry. You know, because these are these are contrary to what the Pope is, what the Pope and the Church is preaching. So, I think social attitudes are changing, and the Church isn't adapting to that.
And what about abortion? If there were a national referendum on that, would it have a chance of passing?
Yeah, I mean, this same poll found that only 26% of all Brazilians and Catholics are for widening the situations where abortion could be would be permissible. And currently, it's only permissible in cases of rape and when the mother's life is at danger. Other polls I've seen have shown that maybe in the 40%, 45% range of Brazilians supporting changing abortion laws.
All right. So the Pope starting his Latin American trip in Brazil. Jack Chang, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
South American correspondent for the McClatchy Newspapers. Today's program produced by Dan Konecki with Christian Bordahl and Karen Radziner. Our technical director is Phoebe Zimmerman. For more information about To the Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To the Point. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.